with the controllers might be good news, because there'll be jobs for your members. Instead, those people who can't drive taxis can be controllers of driverless cars.
Well, look, let me give you, I think the soundbite for this is, you know, this is a solution looking for a problem. And the only way they can make it work is, okay, is to take the people who are previously driving the vehicles and put them in rooms controlling them. Look, it's a complete mystery. Who's going to train these people? Look, it's coming. I've got no doubt about it. Do my members have anything to worry about in central London? Not for a long time yet.
Well, that's really useful and interesting to hear that perspective. Thank you very much indeed. Steve McNamara, General Secretary at the Licensed Taxi Drivers Association, who represents black cab drivers. That is it from me today. My producer was Lizzie Highfield and Ryan Boyden was the technical operator. I will be back tomorrow from 1 p.m. But up next, it's Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
Across the UK, on DAB digital radio, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Hello, good afternoon. It is now 2 o'clock. You're listening to Jane Garvey and Fee Glover here on Times Radio.
And coming up over the next 2 hours, the UK joins with Europe in telling Donald Trump to back off over his demands for Greenland. He is expected to speak in the next hour. We'll bring you that live if he does. We'll ask what life is like for civilians in Ukraine at the moment and hear about the pop star who performs near the front lines. The Hamnet author Maggie O'Farrell is our big guest after 3:30. And what's the deal with airline food? British Airways is axing some of its first-class breakfasts.
Here's the news at 2, Andy Hayes.
Thank you, Jane. Good afternoon. 7 European leaders say Arctic security remains a key priority as Donald Trump sets his sights on Greenland. The US president says he's very serious about seizing the self-governing mineral-rich Danish territory. But in a joint statement, nations including Denmark, the UK, France and Germany say Greenland belongs to its people. The US and Denmark are both members of NATO. Rufus Gifford is a former US ambassador to Denmark under Barack Obama. He's told Times Radio that if the US really wants Greenland, force is the only option.
You have to assume that there's no way diplomatically, considering what I know about Denmark, what I know about Greenland, and certainly what all these players have said publicly, that they would negotiate some sort of sale of Greenland to the United States. Thus, I think the only scenario is some sort of hostile takeover.
The last time the Swiss spa which caught fire was inspected was in 2019. It appears that sparklers in bottles set fire to the ceiling. 40 people died and 116 were injured. Charles Bremner reports for The Times from France.
The chairman of the council of the village, Christophe Ferraud, said that they couldn't understand why this hadn't been done and the council is bitterly sorry about it. But it does raise some very, very big questions about what goes on in the resort, the council, and what the owner was up to.
The Prime Minister has again claimed the UK is turning a corner. He's expected to focus heavily on the cost of living during 2026. He's held his first cabinet meeting of the year.
Renewal is becoming reality. Getting our country back on track is hard, difficult work. And we will reject the politics of easy answers and gimmicks that frankly got us here in the first place.
Polling for The Times, meanwhile, suggests Labour has fallen behind the Conservatives for the first time since the general election. A survey by YouGov puts the Tories on 19% and Labour on 17%. It means the Prime Minister's party is just 1 point ahead of the Lib Dems and only 2 ahead of the Greens. Reform UK are on 26%, down from the summer. The boss of the company that left Tunbridge Wells without water for more than a week has blamed people working from home and unexpected weather for water outages in recent years. South East Water left around 24,000 properties without drinking water in the Kent town last month. And Liam Rossini says he'll give everything to bring success to Chelsea after being confirmed as the club's new manager. The 41-year-old's agreed a 6-year contract at Stamford Bridge. He bid farewell to French club Strasbourg this morning.
This opportunity for me is something that I cannot turn down at this moment in my life for many reasons. One, it's an unbelievable opportunity, an unbelievable club who who are Club World Cup champions with an incredible squad and incredible fan base. Secondly, it means I can go home and see my kids.
And for a roundup of the news on demand, subscribe to the Times News Briefing on any podcast platform.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the Times Radio app, online, and on your smart speaker. Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wickes Kitchens and Bathrooms.
Hello, good afternoon. I know you'll want to hear this, particularly if you're in Scotland. It's been snowing in London, hasn't it, Fee?
It didn't settle, though.
No, it didn't. So don't worry about us. We're all right. But it has been very cold. Welcome to our programme. I know you
don't care. Be fair, Jane, we watched it be cold from our very warm office.
We did. If anything, I was over hot. You can contact us, should you be remotely interested in doing so, on the following WhatsApp number, 0333 003 2353. We're here until 4 o'clock this afternoon, and lots to squeeze in between now and then. We're going to focus, actually, on Ukraine, on daily life in Ukraine today on the programme. The Coalition of the Willing meeting again in Paris. So that's coming up very soon. Airline food has a bad reputation, but honestly, I still think with some fondness about that Aegean Airlines moussaka I had in September. It was really rather lovely. And today we mark the shattering news that BA is no longer going to be serving a hot breakfast on some of its shortest routes from Wednesday of this week. So if you're on one of those quick hops to Brussels or to Jersey, you're going to have to settle for a fruit plate, a yoghurt and a pastry. Well, you'll have to get a wiggle on eating that lot, wouldn't you? You're only on the plane for about 45 minutes.
I think those are really disappointing replacements in a world that has embraced the overnight oat, for example, Jane, and the avocado and the perennial sourdough and the poached egg. I think just the pastry and it'll be very over-chilled fruit, won't it? Yeah. So it won't be for those of us with a sensitive tooth. I think it's really going to cause a lot of trouble.
Yeah, you're always better off with a sausage, fundamentally. Now, London is a hellhole and one of the most dangerous places on earth. That isn't true, but some people want you to believe that. Why? How can we combat the spread of disinformation? Sarah Baxter will join us. She is from the Marie Colvin Centre for International Reporting. She's going to talk all things Trump, Venezuela and Greenland. Now, as Fee mentioned, Trump himself is due to be saying something. We're not quite sure what. We never are. At around 3 o'clock our time, he is talking to Republican politicians. Health news, we've got an appointment with Dr. Rachel Ward at about 3:15. What does she think about this notion of the online hospital? And ramblers in the North York Moors are being warned to be very, very careful because there's a real danger of unexploded ordnance on the moors right now. And our big guest is
Maggie O'Farrell. So she's such a talented novelist. Her novels have already won her the Costa Book Award, the Women's Prize for Fiction and the Betty Trask Award. And she has levelled her very keen gaze at Hamnet, who is the eponymous hero in now a book, a play and a movie. He was the son of William Shakespeare and Anne Hathaway. He had a very short life. And the screen version of Maggie O'Farrell's book is extraordinary. It is incredibly emotionally demanding for anyone who's in the cinema to remain dry-eyed, I think, is almost impossible. It's a work of beauty. It's directed by Chloe Zhao, who won the Oscar for directing Nomadland. So it's got all of the accolades, and it's just a very, very beautiful piece of work about loss and about grief and about redemption.
And that is later on our programme. You can hear from the brilliant, truly brilliant writer, Maggie O'Farrell, talking to Fee after 3:30 this afternoon. So what about the most read stories on the Times website?
In at number three, it is that goodbye to the full English, why British Airways is axing hot breakfasts. It says here, no more sausage on your short haul. That was written by our producer, Rosie. I'm just going to read it with a very straight face, Rosie, the second most read story. England in deep trouble after a day of wayward bowling and missed chances. The Times is, of course, the best place to get all of your Ashes news and analysis. The most read piece on the Times website is Venezuela latest. Greenland belongs to its people, Europe tells Trump. We will keep you across all of that today with everything you need to know. You can read all of those articles on thetimes.com. You'll need your digital subscription. If you don't have one, get one. You can simply go to thetimes.com/subscribe.
You're very welcome this afternoon. The WhatsApp is 0333 003 2353. A meeting between the leaders of the Coalition of the Willing is about to start in Paris. Keir Starmer is there, so too is Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky. Now, the aim is to finalise US security guarantees to prevent Vladimir Putin from reigniting the war in Ukraine once a ceasefire is agreed. European leaders will get a chance to talk to the US Special Envoy, Steve Witkoff. He's there. And so is President Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner. They'll be discussing the possibility of American boots on the ground, we're told. But as those negotiations get underway, we're going to head to Ukraine to find out what life is like for ordinary people attempting to live day-to-day life through the conflict. And first of all, we're going to talk to Kira Rudik, who is leader of the opposition Holos Party in Ukraine. Kira, Happy New Year to you. Tell us a little bit, if it's possible to generalise, about how things are for the people you represent.
Hi, Jane. Hi, Fi. It's good to be back on the show. Happy New Year to you, and thank you for supporting us. The situation in Ukraine is really tough. Over the last 2 to 3 weeks, we only had electricity for 5-6 hours a day. And you can imagine how hard it is to manage the family, to have all your errands be done when you have to wake up during the middle of the night to start your washing machine or to make sure that you redo the dishes, etc. And it has been really tough because Russia continues attacks on our energy infrastructure, and they have been targeting not only energy, but the recent attack was on Ukraine's hospital. But aside of all of this, people are trying to have normal life, to have Christmas celebrations, New Year celebrations. Children are running around. There is this famous video when a couple of hours after the drone hit the hospital on one of Kyiv's regions, kids were riding their sleds around it just a couple of hours after, because we had like this fantastic snow, and every mother wants the kid to have a good childhood, even if it's at the time of war. So people are trying to hold up and celebrate with their families and hope for the best. And you know, the wishes for this New Year's were the same as previous 4 years, for the war to end, for people at the front line to come back, for everybody to be alive and well. Simple as everywhere in Europe.
Kira, I'm so glad that you mentioned the issue of the power cuts and simple things like washing machines, because actually if you're a carer, whether it's for a child or for an older person, this is real day-to-day life struggle, isn't it? You need to wash sheets, you need to make sure everybody's hygienic, and this is incredibly challenging.
It is indeed, because I'm talking about Kyiv right now, but because of the outages in many regions of Ukraine, people do not have proper heating or running water, and it becomes extremely complicated and unmanageable. Even when you're talking about preparing warm food for yourself, for your family, it's getting harder and harder, especially not in the cities, but in the villages where it is much more complicated to get the help. Like, for example, in the city, you know whom to call if you need some help, like such as, for example, bringing warm water to the place where people live. So if their heating is out for this time. But outside of the big cities, it's really, really complicated. And yeah, then the washing machines and dishes becomes less a problem than just simply surviving in the cold and having enough of the warm clothes and being able to have like a proper temperature in the room.
Yeah.
This is why we are trying to help each other.
Of course. Tell us actually, what is the temperature in Kyiv right now? London is a little bit cold. It's about 3 Celsius, I think. We've had a flurry of snow. But this is nothing, really. What's happening there?
So of today, we had, I think, at least 7 centimeters of snow after the night snowfall. And today was -3, -5. But 2 days ago, we had minus 11 and Celsius. And when we are preparing for the next week, it could be down to minus 18. And honestly, it's very hard prediction. And the social services are doing their best right now to prepare people who really need care. But it is indeed very hard, because we are fighting not only against the weather, but that there could be another attacks of Russia and there could be less electricity going on. So, you know, this is not the first time when Putin is using darkness as weapon and weather as weapon. But this winter happens to be extremely hard on people.
Yeah, it certainly sounds it. So are you remotely optimistic about those talks in Paris today?
Well, I want to say I am. And if we look on the bright side, the practical things that are being discussed is something that had to be discussed either right now, 2 years ago, or 2 years after today. However, we are discussing practical things about how to ensure ceasefire and monitor it, how to establish long-term security relations, how to make sure the international forces will be working in Ukraine. But it is all dancing around the most important question. How do you actually make Putin end the war, stop the war? And we do not see a good answer to this question, because this is the obvious elephant in the room. How do you stop Putin from at least attacking us every night? President Trump had an attempt into forcing Putin into a ceasefire. He failed in that. And so we really appreciate the talks that are happening right now. The solution obviously is not in those talks, but in some ways of pressuring Russia into ending the war first.
And bearing in mind what Donald Trump has done in Venezuela, how is that being viewed by the people of Ukraine in terms of how he might deal with President Putin?
Well, there were, you know, many hopes and many jokes saying that President Trump didn't want to help us deal with Russia because he said that Russia is on another continent. Now, like, Venezuela is also on another continent. Then he didn't want to help us because Putin has oil to trade. Well, Venezuela also had oil to trade. And there were many hopes that perhaps the United States will be tougher with Russia from now on. But the main difference between Venezuela and Russia is obvious, is the capacity of nuclear weapons. And that's why there are not too many hopes here that the United States will start being more aggressive with Russia, pressuring Russia. However, there could be an indirect influence on the war in Ukraine, which is if with the proper control, the oil prices will go down. That will hit Russia where it hurts, and that will decrease their ability to continue the war. And that could be really the influence that President Trump promised into the peace through strength.
Kira, we really wish you a very happy and, let's hope, a peaceful new year for you and the people of Ukraine. Kira Rudik is the leader of the opposition Holos Party in Ukraine. Now, one of the people working to make life just a bit brighter for the population of Ukraine is the hugely successful homegrown pop star Olia Polyakova. Here she is. The song is Warrior. She's been very busy singing on the front line. She's worked closely in the past with President Zelensky in his comedy days. And she's using her voice as a kind of cathartic release during some of her country's very, very bleak, bleak contemporary times. Somebody who's interviewed her is the Times media editor, Roz Owen. Hello, Roz. How did you find Olia?
I was quite interested in the side of sort of how culture keeps going in warfare. And obviously we've got a long history in this country and across the world of music being used in warfare. And I thought it was actually a really interesting question how it sort of helps the population cope. So I got a bit interested in the subject, and then someone put me in touch with her and I thought she'd be brilliant for an interview.
Well, she comes across as quite a force. Was that what she was like?
Oh, yeah, completely. Yeah, she's got a bit of Lady Gaga in there. I mean, but sort of forceful, brilliant, strong, really powerful. I mean, she's very, very tall. So one of the things that's funny about the sort of, she used to do comedy skits with Zelensky, and obviously Zelensky's not the world's tallest man. So she sort of the kind of joke is that she can kind of fit him in her pocket type thing. And they look quite funny together in photos, and it's sort of the joke that they've done there. She's quite something. I mean, she's very striking. She's very beautiful. She's much, I thought it was quite interesting that she come to the career later. So she'd been a singer all her life, but from her childhood, but actually the way Ukrainian music had worked, the sort of path to her, she'd become a much bigger star in her 40s, so she's older than some pop stars, although I mean she didn't look it. I was slightly surprised how old she was actually when she told me. What I really thought was incredibly interesting though, that she said, that it was something I hadn't really thought about, is that she talked about how Ukraine had sort of been culturally taken over by the Russians even before the war, and that Ukrainian culture had kind of been dismissed, and she talked about actually how since the war that started to change. She talked about there having been a sort of cultural occupation, and pop music was one area where you sang in Russian if you're Ukrainian, and I'm sure it's true in other former Soviet Union countries too, that you know their own culture was treated as a bit sort of parochial. And actually, since the war, there's been a sort of resurgence in interest in Ukrainian culture. And obviously, you know, she now sings in Ukrainian, which she didn't do before. She sang in Russian.
And I gather that there's quite an atmosphere at her gigs, not least because sometimes they're interrupted by air raids.
Yeah, I mean, that's crazy, isn't it? I mean, it's amazing that she's performing very, very close to the front line. But if you are living there, of course, there aren't many sort of moments of escapism. You know, your life is so dominated by the war. I mean, you've just talked about the sort of the things in your home. But of course, getting outside and actually having some moments of escapism, you know, is a really desirable thing. And so she talked about how the concert started out by being very emotional and people probably feeling emotional catharsis through singing. And then they come away happy and having danced and having had that release. And, you know, keeping up sort of morale in a population where a war has now dragged on for coming up to 4 years. I mean, it is very, very difficult. And music really does have an important role in that. And I thought that was really fascinating.
Yeah, it's a really interesting interview. You can read it on thetimes.com right now. Roz Owen, thank you very much. Just worth saying that Olya Polyakova has appeared on the cover of Ukrainian Playboy. She was the oldest woman ever to do that.
Good for her.
At 46.
Good for her.
Yeah.
Coming up. Well, will you still fly with this airline if there's only a pastry and a fruit plate between London and Newcastle? Question of the day for you there. It's 21 minutes past two now. It's Jane and Fee on Times Radio with Wix. Yeah.
PMQ's Unpacked with Hugo Rifkin.
Every Wednesday at Prime Minister's Questions, they talk about Nigel Farage. But what does Nigel Farage think about it? Usually, he just has to sit there and listen. So tomorrow, from noon, the Reform UK leader joins me and Patrick Maguire while we analyse the exchanges in the Commons. I'm sure we'll let him say a word or two.
PMQ's Unpacked with Hugo Rifkin on Times Radio.
Incredible snorkelling.
Carnival!
Sunrises and sunsets.
Grilled lobster.
Poppycats and kayaking.
Morning swim.
Pina coladas.
Serene spas.
If you love the sound of a Caribbean holiday, then Sandals have every little thing covered. Do it all or do nothing at all. Your perfect holiday is waiting at sandals.co.uk. Sale now on. Atoll protected.
Here's the truth about AI. AI is only as powerful as the platform it's built into. ServiceNow puts AI to work for people across your business, removing friction and frustration for your employees, supercharging productivity for your developers, providing intelligent tools for your service agents to make customers happier. All built into a single platform you can use right now. That's why the world works with ServiceNow. Visit servicenow.com/uk/AI for people.
It might be mid-winter, but there's nothing mid about this offer. The new Samsung Galaxy S25 Ultra brings every winter sport moment to life, as crisp as freshly laid snow. With its stunning 6.9-inch dynamic AMOLED display, razor-sharp resolution. But here's the real win. Claim £250 cashback. Conveniently available to spend in your Samsung wallet. Purchase before January 29th from a participating retailer. Claim on the Samsung website within 30 days of purchase. T's and C's apply.
Listen to Times Radio on your smart speaker. Just say, play Times Radio.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix. The kitchen and bathroom sale is now on. Let the design and installation experts at Wix help transform your home. Get started by booking a free kitchen or bathroom design appointment at wix.co.uk.
Every Wednesday at PMQs, Keir Starmer and Kemi Badenoch talk about their fiercest rival, Nigel Farage. But most of the time, he doesn't get a chance to get a word in. But this week, in a special edition, the leader of Reform UK joins our very own Hugo Rifkin and Patrick Maguire to have his say on the exchanges in the Commons. That is PMQs Unpacked, the alternative version with Nigel Farage, tomorrow from noon, here on Times Radio.
Well, that is something to put into your ears and your diary. 24 minutes past two. So British Airways is axing the full English breakfast for business class passengers on short-haul flights and instead will be offering the continental combination of fruit and a pastry.
Surely you can't be serious.
I am serious. And don't call me Shirley.
It is serious. For those paying for the privilege to fly premium on eight of the airline's shortest routes, joining us to discuss this terrible story and development is Cathy Adams, Travel News Features Editor for The Times and Sunday Times. Cathy, hello.
Hello.
It's devastating news, isn't it?
Absolutely appalling news for the new year, yes. For those of us lucky to fly in Club Europe on what are extremely short flights, yes, unfortunately, there will be no more cooked breakfast and just a pastry, yogurt and a fruit bowl. And there have been a few commentators discussing what exactly will be in the fruit bowl. Doesn't look too much.
How do you get to know of these stories? Did British Airways put out a press release in the first week of January telling you that this was going to happen?
No. So I spent a lot of time, given my job, kind of floating around frequent flyer websites and speaking to lots of, you know, elite flyers, shall we say. And there was outrage over the weekend. I spotted it on Saturday, maybe. Outrage over the weekend about this change. But it isn't the first time that BA has kind of messed with, you know, upper class food. I think a couple of years ago, it decided it would serve brunch, and it was called the Great British Brunch to its premium passengers leaving on flights between 8:30 and 11. Essentially, they won't admit this, but a cost-cutting measure in order to cut back on a full lunch for business class passengers. People were outraged. There was such a huge backlash that then British Airways went, it's fine, it's fine, it's fine. We're now going to just serve breakfast or lunch. So now passengers leaving at that time can choose from one or the other. But yes, British Airways passengers, probably good to say, they are very passionate people and they really care about what they eat. And, you know, a lot of the comments we've had underneath our piece, you know, are saying that, well, that breakfast is really useful to me because I come over from, I don't know, New York, I come transatlantic, and then I want to sleep. And then on the shorter flight, say to Newcastle, Manchester, Belfast, Dublin, they want to eat. So that is quite an important component, I think, for a lot of frequent flyers.
Also, we have to talk about the price, don't we? So I looked at the British Airways website to compare the cost of flying premium to donkey class, my words, not theirs, on those short-haul flights. And actually, in some cases, it's a three-figure difference between those prices. So actually, if you are paying or if your company is paying, the very least you expect is a hash brown, a soggy tomato and a little bit of rubbery omelette.
Totally. I couldn't agree more. I mean, I think the real difference, I've flown on British Airways a lot actually over the past couple of weeks, flew back on Sunday night from Glasgow, down the back, of course. I never usually travel up the front on such short flights. But, you know, you go on board, you're all boarding the very same plane, and all you get if you go in Club Europe, which is their, you know, word for sort of business class for shorter flights, you just get one normal seat and then you get that kind of middle seat blocked off with a little tray. That's all you're getting, really, for your money. Obviously, you get access to the bar, but I think a lot of readers are complaining that, well, that is part of your price. You know, your luggage gets there at the same time, you earn the same number of miles. There's really no benefit to flying, you know, in the business class cabin if you're flying
Time. So you're not getting the much wider seat, you're not getting the extra leg room.
No, you're not landing any sooner. Yeah. You know, your baggage might come out a little bit earlier, and obviously you do get access to the lounge beforehand. But yeah, I mean, food and drink is really one of the only things that airlines can offer to kind of add value to your ticket price.
I also noted in your piece that the reasoning given by British Airways is going to make some people raise their eyebrows. So to say that one of the reasons they've done this is so that the crew can spend more time with passengers. Well,
doing what?
On a 45-minute flight from London to Newcastle, how much time does a passenger expect to spend with the crew?
Well, yes, that is, I think, one of the biggest questions, you know, and a lot of frequent flyers have been quite outspoken about the fact that what are they really doing? I mean, you know, you're on a 45-minute flight from London to Newcastle. You're going to be strapped in for the first 10 minutes and for the last 10 minutes. So what are you supposed to get in sort of 20 minutes between that? This, I think, is their way of saying, you know, we have trialled it. Customers supposedly were happy with it. But notably, they're not including it on London to Scotland flights. And I don't know the reason yet. But if you are flying from London
they're
to...
They're just simply not brave enough, Cathy.
I mean, those angry Scots, I wouldn't want to cross them. So, yes, we shall see how popular it is. Yeah. And it's all being rolled out from tomorrow.
It just seems very unimaginative to go for fruit and a pastry, Cathy. In a world where breakfasts can be incredibly dynamic these days and people are after their protein and they're after their
Such
health.
A good point.
And actually pastry and a bit of fruit.
I mean, they don't travel well either, do they?
Just throw a load of hard-boiled eggs down the plane.
They will both be great tasteless because they will be so chilled, won't they?
I mean, soggy as well. I don't know if the pastry is going to arrive sort of on the same plate as all the fruit, but I wouldn't want to equally eat a very soggy pastry, but I think probably my money's on them being quite dry.
Do you want, I bet that comment section underneath your piece is a joyful place.
It's quite the place to be.
It is a venting of spleens, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. I think we could probably see all of Great Britain represented in that comment section. Let's go there. Lovely stuff, Cathy. Very nice to see you. Thank
lovely
you very much
to talk
indeed
to you.
For
Thank
coming
you.
In today. Cathy Adams is Travel News Features Editor for The Times and Sunday Times.
Do let us know if you've ever had a cracking airline meal. Bye-bye. Nice to see you. Can you remember one that just lingers?
Do you know what? I'm always so grateful to be served food on a plane,
yeah,
Jane.
It's a novelty.
It's that kind of childhood thing as well, because my sister and I travelled from such a young age because our dad lived three time zones away. And we used to fantasise about that meal that came round and the tiny little bowls of individual things that arrive, which is the airline's way, especially on a long-haul flight, of filling your time to stop the passengers getting too bored. Everything about an airline meal I enjoy. I mean, of course it's not going to be haute cuisine. No. I mean, you'd be daft to have that expectation.
No, but there is something about the way it's packaged and just some of the mystery surrounding it.
I love it all. So just for a moment, take us to your moussaka.
No, God, it was gorgeous. I mean, I think the flight to Greece is it's quite a useful 4 hours. You can really relax on a 4 hour flight if it's to
Now, this Athens. Isn't what you said about it before, but I can't let this pass. Yes, you said that Greece was too far away and they should
They should move it closer, but in terms of food, it does give you time to enjoy. And I'm going to say begin to digest what they provide. So maybe it's the expectation because I know I'm going to Greece and I'm excited about it that I love the food so much. But I don't know, for whatever reason, that moussaka in September really hit the spot.
Excellent.
Really was nice. They don't give you much, but by golly, it was good. Right, next on Times Radio, is disinformation in diplomacy anything new at all? It's just after 2:30, disgracefully. Times Radio, here are the headlines from Andy Hayes.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Jane, good afternoon. European leaders, including Keir Starmer, say Greenland belongs to its people and it's for Denmark and Greenland and them only to decide on matters concerning them. They've been reacting to threats from Donald Trump to seize the territory. In a joint statement, leaders said the island's future belongs to its people. They added, however, that the US remains an essential partner in Arctic security. Defence analyst Michael Clark.
I'm sure it's nothing to do with defence. It is to do with control of the resources that are believed to be in such a big place and the idea that he loves the sense, I think, that another part of the map will be coloured in the same colours of the United States.
Swiss authorities have revealed that the bar where 40 people died in a New Year fire had not been inspected since 2019. The mayor of Crans, Montana, has also announced that sparklers, which are blamed for starting the blaze, are now banned inside venues. The first named storm of the year is expected to hit the UK on Thursday, exacerbating the freezing conditions. Forecasters say Goretti is likely to bring more heavy snow. Mandatory eye tests for drivers over 70 may be brought in as part of new road safety measures. The government will also consider cognitive assessments for older motorists. And Liam Rossini is the new manager of Chelsea after agreeing a six-year deal at Stamford Bridge. The 41-year-old's left French club Strasbourg and will be in the stands for tomorrow's Premier League derby against Fulham. And for a roundup of the news on demand, find the Times News briefing on the Times Radio app.
This is Times Radio.
Cancer Research UK is funding the breakthroughs that matter. Did you know that over the past 50 years, their work has helped double cancer survival in the UK? Cancer Research UK science expert Dr. Sam Godfrey talks about the breakthroughs that could change the lives of people affected by cancer.
One of the breakthroughs that I'm so excited about is that our scientists discovered that the human papillomavirus actually caused almost all cervical cancers and a number of other cancers too. This has meant we've been able to develop a vaccine, and that is now expected to prevent almost 90% of cervical cancers in the UK. With screening as well, we think we're going to get to a point where we can stop almost all cervical cancers, and we're going to see a future where cervical cancer is effectively eradicated. It's such an exciting thing, and it just scratches the surface of what really is the golden age of research.
Witness more incredible research breakthroughs in Cancer Detectives Finding the Cures, brought to you by Cancer Research UK. Stream now on Channel 4. Cancer Research UK is a registered UK charity.
It turns out you can please all of the people, all of the time. Garden games for the kids, a separate cottage for the grandparents, a private chef for that special occasion. Simpson Travel, idyllic Mediterranean holidays that everyone will love. We take care of the details so you can enjoy the moment. SimpsonTravel.com, because your time is precious.
Get the day's politics, business and sport every weekday in Breakfast from 6:30 a.m.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix. Rated excellent on Trustpilot. Book a free kitchen or bathroom design appointment and start your own excellent home transformation with Wix. Find your nearest showroom and book your appointment at wix.co.uk.
So many listeners are travelling everywhere, aren't they?
Well, they are, and they're thoroughly enjoying the airline meals by and large. Elizabeth Clare says, cracking airline meals. We flew on Emirates Economy over Christmas, just delicious Christmas turkey. I usually fly business on Emirates because of family member reductions. I have to say I much prefer the economy food. Swiss Air used to be quite good. Actual cooked meals. That's coming in from Ush. And who was it who said that they had to have a vegan meal and ended up enjoying it? Oh, look, it's Nicola. We were travelling club class on BA some time ago. We'd chosen our meal. They'd run out of everything. But vegan. You should have seen my husband's face. However, we both enjoyed the tastiest meal on a plane journey, and I made sure my husband told the air hostess. It's a very kind thing to do. Hello, John.
Hi, Fee. So what's going on? Look, in less than half an hour now, President Trump is going to be speaking in Washington. He's talking to a partisan audience of Republicans on Capitol, from Capitol Hill. So I guess that means he's not going to be his normal, you know, subtle and retiring self. He's probably going to be quite bold in what he has to say, whether it's about America, whether it's about the world, whether it's about South America, Europe. We'll just have to wait and see. But I'm guessing it's going to make news. So it'll be happening while you're here. I'll be coming on at 4:00. We'll see what it really, really meant. I think it's going to mean something. And around 6:15, the European leaders in Paris are due to go a news conference about what they've decided and maybe less about what they haven't decided, which will also be there, on support for Ukraine, when and if there is a ceasefire, and support from America for some sort of multinational force, if there is support from America, there'll be some sort, we're told. We don't know what kind. So those are the sort of stories that we're draping the programme over a bit later on. And the kind of subtext is the thing that European leaders don't want to talk about. You know, the reality, which is that while they're trying to smooth talk, President Trump's envoys in Paris. The reality is that America has already as good as turned away from the Western alliance and from European NATO, and as well as turning away what happened in Venezuela from the idea of a rule-based order based on common understanding of international law. All this has been going on, and it's happening and happening now. But you hear our leaders, like Keir Starmer, just so reluctant to frame it in simple English. And I'm guessing that's going to go on. So we're going to be talking about what does go on. And I'm going to be talking to a range of people, pretty high-level diplomatic and political players, like the former US ambassador to Venezuela, a former chief of staff to Maduro in Venezuela. I've got Kurt Volker coming on, former US ambassador to NATO and a former Danish minister for Greenland. And that's for NATO, Lord Dannett, the former head of the British Army. He's coming on. So between us, I think we're going to be covering a lot of ground that the various leaders in Paris are going to be maybe a little bit more reluctant to say out loud.
John, thank you very much. John starts at 4 o'clock here on Times Radio. And as we have said, Donald Trump is expected to say something, nobody quite knows what, over the next hour or two. And we will bring that to you live here on Times Radio just as soon as it happens.
OK, now, I think the airline food debate, I think we've got a winner, a clear one. Maureen in Preston says, my best airline food experience, Singapore Airlines business class, lobster thermidor with matched wines. And if you don't want the menu being served on board, you can use their Book the Cook service and pre-book a meal from a Michelin chef.
You wouldn't want to get off the plane, would you?
Just circle the world.
And actually just stay in Singapore Airport, which is, I think, the only airport in the world to have a swimming pool. Turn around and come back. Sounds like a lovely trip.
There's a holiday. Right, the Tudors apparently said that an ambassador was an honest gentleman sent abroad to lie for his country. Well, today, a minister has told Parliament that the UK faces an increasing and evolving quantity of lies. Or more politely, disinformation. All meant to undermine us and our way of life. Now, one example raised by MPs were claims on social media about serious crime in London, despite the statistics which tell us that actually serious crime is falling in London. Here is the Foreign Office Minister Stephen Doughty's response.
What I would say is I think we're doing a good job in defending, and I think, you know, of course the British people are part of this too, and I think people are incredibly savvy now at spotting fakes, at spotting issues, but, you know, these threats are evolving, they're expanding. The figures you cite don't surprise me at all. We all see it as individual members of Parliament on our own social media accounts. And that's where I come back to the first point I was making. This is information warfare. This is not just individual tweets or individual posts on TikTok. This is coordinated, systematic efforts by adversaries to undermine our democracy and that of allies and partners, particularly around key topics like support for Ukraine.
Foreign Office Minister Stephen Doughty. Well, James Ball is a journalist and an expert on disinformation. He's written books including Post-Truth, How Bullshit Conquered the World. James, it sounds as though certainly Stephen Doughty recognises the problem. What could the government do about it? What is the government doing about it, if anything?
I think the government's trying to tackle this problem as quietly as it can. Unfortunately for the UK's efforts to tackle disinformation or polarisation, even when it's driven by Russia or by China or other adversaries, is that the US government has decided it's very against efforts to crack down on disinformation. It's actually classed these as censorship and tied it into a narrative that European countries are censoring, opposing, or non-politically correct views. And so it means for a government that's trying to deal with this, they have to try and find ways to tackle the online conversation, to try and sort of stop these narratives taking hold and destabilizing them, but without looking like they are doing something that will upset a pretty vital ally in the US. And that has made all of this work vastly more difficult, especially as America is sort of personally cracking down on individuals who work in this space, including British citizens.
Right. It actually, the way you describe it there, it just sounds hopeless, James. We can't do anything, can we?
I think the difficulty is it's very easy to make people more sceptical online. If, you know, if you hear that lots of supposed users on social media are bots or are, you know, being paid by Russia or some other adversary to push messages, makes it a lot easier to see something that you disagree with and go, well, that's probably a bot, that's probably bad. What's really hard is actually keeping trust, is keeping discussions, is keeping debate. You know, we are a high trust society. Most Western European countries are, and that's our strength. You know, we can disagree. We can have functional elections. We can have transitions of power. That's what Russia can't do. That's what dictatorships can't do. And basically, a lot of these operations are trying to drag us down to that level. They're using real debates and real discussions, and they're kind of punching the bruise. And so we need to try and look to what can make us trust each other, what can make us have proper conversations, what can stop them being derailed by these bad faith actors, rather than just sort of going, what can divide us more, what can push us more? And I did like when he was giving evidence this morning, you know, the minister did stress that a lot of these operations aren't very good. They're kind of crude. They don't reach very far. They're not very subtle. And so just because they're trying all the time to push this doesn't mean that it's game over.
But let's just be honest about it. If a chunk, let's say a sizable chunk of the population, isn't very clever, then the disinformation doesn't have to be very good, does it?
I think that's a little bit unfair.
Well, I'm being as bleak and as realistic as I dare to be.
I think part of it is that we are pretty good at dividing ourselves on our own. We are quite angry at the moment. There is a lot of real issues that polarise us. We are polarised on issues like immigration. And what Russian information efforts do in particular is they don't try and make you go, isn't Russia brilliant? I love Russia. They just try and make us more divided, more upset, and less able to act. And so part of it is, if we can actually try and look at the good version of the argument we disagree with, you know, disagree in good faith, try not to be in the shouting match, we'll do better. We will feel happier. There is evidence that we feel better when we don't fight online. And we will have a better public debate. The problem is that it is really, really satisfying in the short term to fight online. And that means that we're more likely to pick up on these really aggressive, really inflammatory responses.
Yeah, because it's a game. And if we're honest about ourselves, some of us quite like to play it. It's entertaining, isn't it? Or it can be.
I think we've all done it. I certainly have. You sort of see something online, it gets your blood up, you think of a really pithy response, and especially if you've got a bit of a following on social media, you know, I don't have hundreds of thousands, but I've got tens of thousands. You get a bit of a dopamine rush if you do that little QT dunk, and it's very easy to feed into that and get into that cycle. And I think it's important that the government's disinformation efforts shouldn't be about what you or I do. It shouldn't be about what you or I say. It should be about looking at foreign governments, other agencies trying to manipulate us and how they work with it. We should be able to be idiots online, even if, you know, we should be trying to encourage each other to be better. They should only be focusing their efforts on inauthentic attempts to manipulate that. And that should be at the level of working with social networks, level of disrupting and blocking these operations. They do need to be a lot better at saying it's not about stopping British people express their opinions, provided they fall short of hate speech. And I think a lot of this disinformation efforts can sound a bit nannying, or can sound like it's telling us not to say things we think are true. That isn't what they're about.
How keen are the social networks in working with democratic countries and democratically elected governments like our own?
They're not keen at all to do it, to be honest, because they tried it and it didn't work out very well for them. Quite famously, the social networks blocked Donald Trump after his role in inciting the January the 6th riots 5 years ago this week. And that got them huge blowback from Republicans. They got called in front of Congress. They had to disclose loads of evidence. They got monstered on Fox News. They care a lot about the American media sphere, more than they do here, because America can rein them in. And the left didn't back them up. Democrats didn't cheer them on or say, thank you for saving us, because we have so many other reasons we're angry with big tech. And so it became painful for them to act on disinformation. It became painful for them to act on these influence operations. And so they've signed up with the Trump train. You know, Mark Zuckerberg came out and apologised for tackling disinformation. They've stopped funding it. Elon Musk aggressively boosts a lot of hostile disinformation in the UK. He personally boosts the narrative that London is deadly, where there is not a single American city that is as safe as London. Not one. London is safer than every single place above a million pops.
We just can't say that often enough, can we? I mean, I've got friends who don't live in London who fear for me as I walk the crime-strewn streets. And I'm fine.
I mean, it's the thing. It's a great city, yes. It has a slightly higher crime rate than small towns in the UK. It's about the same as other cities. Mm. And it is between twice as safe and 20 times as safe as most major American cities. And yet you will get concerned American friends who just think that it's terrible here. So this stuff works, but the social networks aren't interested at the moment. And if we're honest, they're not going to be until there's a change of government or a change in politics in America. This isn't in our power. We don't run the internet. And so I think realism about how they approach it, rather than the government constantly sort of pretending they can fix things they can't, I think is probably helpful here too. You know, they can't censor the internet even if they wanted to at this stage.
Well, you've cheered everybody up there, James. Thank you very much indeed, and a happy new year to you. James Ball, the journalist and disinformation expert.
The bit that I don't understand, Jane, is why some parts of the MAGA movement and some parts of right-wing Christian America aren't more angry with that collusion
between parts of...
the tech industries and Trump. So if you look at the latest development and what Grok AI can do, which is to take women's clothes off, you know, with an algorithm that is built specifically to do that, you cannot surely still be in that camp and say that you have a morality. That, you know, the two things have become so, so far apart that there's no confusion as to what's going on here.
No, but we've always been a bit baffled. I think I can speak for you here about that link between evangelical Christians and support for Donald Trump. I've never really got that.
No, but I think there are so many lines that get crossed now where people are getting so immediately hurt. So we take all of your comments very seriously. If you'd like to send us a WhatsApp, we're 0333 003 2353. It's been a while since I've said that. I think it came out right.
Yeah, that's good.
Well done. It is 10 minutes to 3. You're listening to Jane and Fee on Times Radio with Wix. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
Times Radio Breakfast with Nationwide. Start your day with Times Radio's essential morning briefing. With intelligent conversation and incisive analysis from some of the most respected names in politics, culture and entertainment. Hear well-informed opinion and quality journalism on all the big stories making the headlines. Times Radio Breakfast, tomorrow morning from 6, with Nationwide, a good way to bank.
Download the free Times Radio app and listen to us wherever you are.
I always enjoy going back to my childhood home to see Mum and Dad, but as they get older, the more and more guilty I would feel, you know, about leaving them on their own, especially in winter when it's so cold and miserable outside. I visit as often as I can with the rest of my family, but Mum and Dad really need someone around who can help them more regularly than we can. So thank goodness for Ellie. She's their care professional from home instead, and she actually lives with Mum and Dad, which means she can be there for them whenever they need her. It gives us real peace of mind. Mum and Dad really don't want to leave their home, and we don't want them to either. So living care from home instead was the perfect solution for us. It's been amazing. And Ellie's made such a difference to their lives too. They are so much happier, so much better in themselves. So now, whenever I visit them, they don't feel like Mum and Dad who need to be looked after. They feel like my parents again.
For award-winning home care you can trust, go to homeinstead.co.uk.
If you could sail anywhere in the world, where would you go? With Oceania Cruises, our small luxurious ships allow us to dock in boutique ports in 600 stunning destinations. We offer a more immersive experience and a personalized service, creating unique travel memories. From the Caribbean to the Mediterranean and the finest cuisine at sea, it can only be Oceania Cruises. Visit OceaniaCruises.com or your travel agent.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, and on your smart speaker, Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
Right, let's talk about health news from the week. The NHS was able to keep 95% of planned appointments during the doctors' strike, despite more than 2,000 resident doctors walking out. Let's talk to Dr. Rachel Ward, co-host of the Pharmacy Podcast, very much our resident GP. Rachel, hello, how are you? And a very happy new year to you. This sounds like an incredible feat here.
Good afternoon, yeah, and happy new year to both of you as well. Lovely to be back for the new year. Yeah, this is a really interesting story. So 95% of appointments carried on electively during the doctor strike, which was the 17th to the 22nd of December. There was a lot of discussion around it at the time because we were obviously in the depths of really difficult times with flu. And obviously, you know, people wanting to get out of hospital before Christmas. And there was real concern about the impact that the strikes would have. Now, I think there's a few interesting figures in this story. First of all, the number of junior doctors who went on strike in this period increased. I certainly, you know, have had this feeling going along with multiple strikes, thinking, is this waning? Are fewer people going out on strike? But actually 2,000 more approximately resident doctors were absent from work each day compared to the last episode. And I think this really demonstrates how some of the kind of rhetoric that Wes Streeting had in the run-up to that strike, some of the coverage it was getting, really actually reignited the passion in those junior doctors to get out and make their point. But I think when we look at the fact that 95% of elective care continued, my question to that is, at what cost? So was the quality of care still as good? Were there rushed discharges? Were there more mistakes made? So I think we can look at the positives in this, but it never tells the full story. And of course, what is the pressure that was put on those staff that were still there, being expected to continue their normal duties and cover their 20,000 absent resident doctors? So I think it's just part of the tale.
There surely will also have been some patients who simply didn't attend a hospital because they thought there is a strike going on, it is the wrong time for me to present, and we might start to see that kind of backlog emerging over this week and next week.
Yeah, and certainly if you remember back to the start of COVID, for example, people were staying away from hospital, even when they had emergency conditions. And that was very worrying. So you're right. I think we don't have those figures. You know, was there a delay in diagnosis for certain people, which can definitely be detrimental? You're absolutely right. So, again, a thing to consider.
For the moment, though, it's very much being taken as a win by the Health Secretary. And we will talk more about this issue because you always give us an interesting insight, Rachel. But let's turn our attention to two other stories. The NHS is going to launch a kind of online hospital to treat common conditions such as the menopause, very common in women, and prostate issues as well, in a bid to end the postcode lottery of care. What does an online hospital actually mean to a patient?
Yeah, so this is part of the 10-year plan. So looking at some conditions which can be managed with remote consultation. And it means that really you could meet anywhere across the country and accessing, this option rather than being on a waiting list, waiting to go to your local hospital, for example. I mean, since COVID, there are a lot of remote consultations that take place from hospitals as it is. So, for example, where I work, a lot of the rheumatology consultations occur remotely, and that's happened since COVID, and it's much more time efficient in many ways. So this is to kind of centralise another service that people can choose. Conditions like the menopause, menstrual disorders, certain eye conditions like cataracts, glaucoma, inflammatory bowel disease. So these can, you can choose to have a remote consultation with a consultant that could be anywhere in the country. So I think it's good in that it gives us more options. I think remote consultations definitely have their positives. But what we have to think about is many of these conditions, that initial consultation is just the first step. So you're obviously not going to have your cataracts fix remotely. So it's great, you know, having that consultation, but then what's the waiting time to actually have your cataracts treated? Or what's the waiting time to then go and have the imaging that you need or the procedure that you need? So if this is going to be successful, it needs to have a match in the capacity of the next step of care, if you like.
Can I ask you as well, Rachel, whether you think you are as good a doctor online as you are in the room?
So I think for certain things, it absolutely lends itself to remote consulting and we use it more. There is definitely subtleties which are lost when you do remote consulting. And what I would also say is for more complex patients that are not just, they do not present with one simple condition, it generally is not as good. And I think also this idea of having, a remote doctor not linked to different departments in that setting could also be problematic. You know, so I've got patients, for example, who, yeah, they may consult with the menopause service, but they also need to liaise with haematology, cardiology, respiratory, because they have complex conditions. So that kind of complexity will not lend itself. But sometimes it's useful.
Sure. And there must be some patients who are better patients online than they are in the room too. Very quickly, the number of deaths in the UK could soon exceed the number of births. This is from the think tank, the Resolution Foundation. Would a population decline be such a bad thing in terms of healthcare? We know it might affect the economy, all kinds of other things, but in healthcare, Rachel?
Yeah, well, we are getting to that situation where, we're going to have an increasing proportion of elderly people in our population. So that will continue to be proportionally higher. And of course, as you get older, you need more healthcare and you need carers, which is a real, real issue already in the UK, finding people to do care work. And actually, if you look across our care population, many of them are people who were born in other countries. With our lower birth rates, yes, this will be a problem for healthcare. And it is likely that we will rely more on more of people coming from other countries to work in our health and social care situation. Mm. So it was definitely something to watch.
Rachel, always good to talk to you. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
Dr. Rachel Ward, co-host of the Pharmacy Podcast, a GP in her own right and very much our adopted GP too.
She is. She knows all our secrets. It's almost 3 o'clock.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Good afternoon to you. It's Jane Garvey and Fee Glover here on Times Radio. In the next hour, the UK has joined Europe in telling Donald Trump to back off over his demands for Greenland. We're going to hear from the former NATO head of policy planning in our next hour. We should also hear from Donald Trump. He is scheduled to make a speech starting around now. We'll find out what's been stopping ramblers in their tracks on the North York Moors. And our big guest is the phenomenal writer Maggie O'Farrell, author of the best-selling novel Hamnet. The film of that novel is out this week, starring Jesse Buckley and Paul Mescal. So Maggie Farrell talking after 3:30 this afternoon. The news at 3, here's Andy Hayes.
Thank you, Jane. Good afternoon. An expert police review of the decision to ban Israeli fans from attending a football match in Birmingham recommended that they should be allowed to attend. That was more than 2 weeks before the fixture. The decision to ban supporters was made after police received intelligence that locals in the predominantly Muslim area were hostile to the Maccabi fans. The decision has been branded anti-Semitic. Craig Guildford, the chief constable of West Midlands Police, is answering questions from MPs at the moment. European nations, including Britain, say the future of Greenland must be decided by its people and by Denmark in response to threats from Donald Trump. In a joint statement, the leaders of Britain, France, Germany, Italy, Poland, Spain and Denmark said Arctic security relied upon US and NATO allies adhering to the principles of sovereignty and territorial integrity. Michael Evans, a former defence editor of The Times, says the US has a military base in Greenland.
They have jurisdictional right over that area of Greenland because it's a large base, but they don't have jurisdictional rights over the rest of Greenland, which is a huge island. So I really don't see how that's going to be justified. It all depends on what really Trump has in mind. Is he really going to send military troops or forces of some kind to seize Greenland.
There's a meeting in Paris today between European leaders and US representatives. A Swiss bar that caught fire, killing 40 people during New Year celebrations, had not been inspected since 2019. The local mayor, Nicolas Ferrer, has apologised at a news conference this afternoon.
We have decided to commission a specialised external firm to carry out an inspection of our 128 public buildings in the municipality as quickly as possible. As part of this mandate, the municipality will also request an inspection of materials, even though the law does not require it. Otherwise, the inspection will fail to achieve its objective, which is to enhance safety.
Sparklers, which are blamed for starting the blaze, are now banned inside venues. The boss of the company that left Tunbridge Wells without water for more than a week has blamed people working from home and unexpected weather for water outages in recent years. South East Water left around 24,000 properties without drinking water in the Kent town last month. The technology secretary says Elon Musk's X must deal urgently with its inbuilt artificial intelligence tool. Grok has apparently been used to fake sexual images, including of children. Users, mostly women, have reported that account holders have used Grok to generate images of them without clothing. Liz Kendall says no one should have to undergo such an ordeal. And Chelsea have a new manager. Liam Rossini has signed a six-year contract at Stamford Bridge. And for a roundup of the news on demand, find the Times News Briefing on the Times Radio app.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the Times Radio app, online, and on your smart speaker.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens and Bathrooms.
It's 3 minutes past three. It is Fee Glover and Jane Garvey with you until 4 o'clock this afternoon. We will roll with the geopolitical times in the next hour because we have been told that Donald Trump, President Trump, is at the Trump Kennedy Center addressing Republican legislators and is going to say something. As soon as that happens, we will bring it to you live. But in the meantime, that is the story that we're going to cover, the direction of President Trump's gaze. European leaders, including Keir Starmer, have told President Trump that Greenland belongs to its people and not the United States. That statement came in the last half an hour. It follows growing rhetoric from the White House. Deputy Chief of Staff Stephen Miller has said that Denmark wouldn't fight the US for its territory.
It has been the formal position of the US government since the beginning of this administration, frankly, going back into the previous Trump administration, that Greenland should be part of the United States. The president has been very clear about that. That is the formal position of the U.S. government.
Right, but can you say that military action against Greenland is off the table?
It wouldn't be military action against Greenland. The Greenland has a population of 30,000 people, Jake. The United States should have Greenland as part of the United States. There's no need to even think or talk about this in the context that you're asking of a military operation. Nobody's going to fight the United States.
Well, Donald Trump is expected to address Republican politicians shortly. He has been buoyed by the success of recent American operations to capture the Venezuelan president. This is a dispute, though, between two NATO states. In a moment, we'll hear from the alliance's former head of policy planning, Fabrice Potier. But first, let's go to the US and join Sarah Baxter, director of the Mary Colvin Center for International Reporting. A very good afternoon from us in London, Sarah. Greenland isn't a narco state. It is not headed by a man who appears to have many criminal connections. It isn't posturing against America. Nobody should confuse America's actions in Venezuela with any potential actions in Greenland.
Well, the thing about Greenland is it's so much easier to conquer, in inverted commas, than in Venezuela. I mean, that really could be an operation where the US just moves in and takes control, because as Stephen Miller said, there's only a very small population there. It's mostly a lot of ice and, by the way, rare earth minerals and all kinds of things that Donald Trump covets. There's a lot more concern about Venezuela and the idea of a forever war there, or at least a lot of instability that the US taxpayers will be on the hook for. Now, of course, there were huge demonstrations only a few months ago against Donald Trump, you know, called the No Kings protests. But it's almost like these should be updated to say No Emperor, because increasingly he does seem to want to add countries to his belt. And he doesn't really care anymore what MAGA thinks about that, the idea of getting into, difficult forever wars. He thinks he is MAGA. He said as much very recently. And he said he's going to be in charge of Venezuela. He can, you know, his aides are saying he can invade Greenland any day now if he wants to, or not even invade, just take control. And stuff it. And I think all his eyes now are on expansionism and his legacy in these 3 years that he has left as president. That's if he doesn't decide to upend the constitution and stand again or prolong his term. So this is the period that we're entering now.
It's interesting what you say there, Sarah, about the fact that he doesn't appear to care about MAGA anymore. He believes himself to be MAGA. And his approval ratings are extremely low, aren't they? So are you saying that he's just gone into that place where he no longer feels the need of the people to adore and love him? And that is a dangerous place, isn't it, for any leader to find themselves in?
Well, first of all, he loves himself most of all, and he wants to go down in the history books as, one of the greats in his view. He's always comparing himself to Washington and Lincoln and suggesting that he might be better than either of them. So this is one of his ambitions. Now, regarding his popularity ratings, I mean, Reuters Ipsos had a very interesting poll just in the last day or two where it came out with, say, 1 in 3 voters opposed intervention in Venezuela. 72% of Americans feared what the consequences might be, but a fairly, low but nevertheless majority of Republicans are sticking with him on this, as they will on many issues. And his approval ratings, interestingly, rose from 39% in December to 42% just now. Now, that might be just statistical noise. 42% is still very low. But, of course, there's always a bit of American pride in the military achieving something very fast and well. These do not, though, I should say, compare to the kind of approval ratings that President Bush got in the early days of invading Iraq and Afghanistan, and then we all know what happened.
Yeah, but it's important, isn't it, to understand what happened there. And what do you think might happen now in Venezuela?
Well, Donald Trump has very recently said, he may reiterate this when he speaks this morning, that he is now in charge. Asked by NBC who runs it, he said, "I run it." But can he really run it from abroad with his satraps and, with keeping the existing regime minus Nicolas Maduro in place? I mean, there are so many questions there. And I do think the American public, while wanting to be supportive, is genuinely bewildered by the fact that this didn't seem to be the Donald Trump they were voting for. By the way, today is January the 6th, and it was 5 years ago to this day that the storming of the Capitol occurred. And that event is being completely airbrushed from history now.
Yes, it's as if the zone is flooded. Good to talk to you, Sarah. Thank you. That's Sarah Baxter, Director of the Mary Colvin Centre for International Reporting. Well, let's bring in Fabrice Potier, former head of NATO policy planning, now chief executive of the Rasmussen Global Consultancy. A very good afternoon from us in London, Fabrice. We've never seen a confrontation like this between NATO states before. What do you make of it?
Well, I would not talk of confrontation. I would talk of more tension and a real question mark as to whether Donald Trump is going to put into action his own statements and the statements of his own officials. And that will cross a very significant red line, which is the major ally, the United States, going after another ally's territory. And I think the Danish Prime Minister is spot on when she says that this will be probably the end of NATO, at least the end of NATO the way it has been conceived all along. So I think we're in one of those quite, I would not say dramatic hour, probably pre-dramatic hour,
but we're one of those moments where everybody's holding their breath.
Yeah, and you say it's not a confrontation. I think many people will say yet, because if you have a man like Stephen Miller saying, hey, there are only 30,000 people, there's a kind of dot, dot, dot after that, isn't there? I mean, it sounds like very threatening language on the one hand, promising language on the other, depending on whose side you're on.
Yes, absolutely. But I think Stephen Miller is one of the more hawkish voices in the White House, and clearly a voice that has gained even more influence than in during the first Trump mandate. And he was also one of the few senior officials who was in the secret of the preparation for the Venezuela operation. So I think we have to take everything they say seriously, because indeed Donald Trump is often quite coherent between what he says and what he does. They are not, however, talking about military operation. They have not deployed, like they did during many months, a major fleet or major military operation in the coast of Venezuela. So we are not looking at the same scenario here, the same pre-deployment. However, I think what I get, you know, I work also in Copenhagen. We have one of our main offices there, is that he feels strongly about Greenland. And it's not just about economics. It's not about critical raw materials. It's this kind of the bully who wants to feel safe in his own hemisphere. And it's very psychological, very personal. And against that, it's really hard to have rational arguments, because if you look at the current defense agreement between the U.S. and Denmark, it's actually very open and very flexible to whatever the U.S. would like to do there.
Yeah.
It's just, I think it's not about military presence. It's about owning that piece of land.
Do you know, Fabrice, when the last time was that the 30,000 people of Greenland were asked very specifically for their thoughts on America being more involved in their country? I mean, it is not a country that has had the easiest of relationships with Denmark.
Absolutely. And there have even been different prime ministers, Danish prime ministers, who have apologized on the record for profound mistakes that were made by Copenhagen vis-a-vis the Inuit population, the Greenlandish population. However, the paradox, it's a bit like Putin in Ukraine. The more Putin invades Ukraine, the more Ukrainians feel. And it's a bit the same with the Greenlanders. The more Trump threatens to take over Greenland, the more they feel Greenlanders, and the more actually they get closer to Copenhagen, where you're right, they're the relationship has not been easy, but it's actually got better over the past few months because of this threat that is looming on the continent.
There have been some very firm words of condemnation for any aggression towards Greenland that have come out of the meeting of European leaders in Paris today. But how specifically do you think the Danes need to react? How much of a voice, just their voice alone, do we need to hear at the moment?
Well, first, we should not hear only Danish voices. That's obvious. There has to be unity, European unity, or around this, because this is not just about the Greenland territory. It's about the principle that could be a fundamental principle that could be broken if the United States were to annex Greenland. And for that, Europe has to stand very firm and very clear. However, where we are in a tough spot, quite frankly, is we don't really have the capabilities, obviously, to respond to a possible U.S. military incursion. And the U.S. is still the main guarantor of European security for the European allies. So we're in a really tough spot, and we have to be very firm in the diplomatic language. And I think this is what this statement is saying. But in terms of action, we have to thread a very thin line.
How unhelpful do you think it might be to our NATO allies that our Prime Minister has been, in many people's eyes, a bit flabby in his response to America's capture of the Venezuelan leader? And what does that mean to the respect that we should all have of international law?
Well, frankly, I think he's not an exception.
Sadly, I think most European leaders have been quite flabby. Why? I think Ukraine is very much on their minds. And they're, as you know, today they're hosting a coalition of the willing meeting in Paris, where they're trying to get the US position better aligned with the European and the Ukrainian one. So I think they're trying not to compromise this very painful but relatively successful rapprochement between Washington and Europe and Kiev on some of the fundamental principles of a possible peace resolution. So I think this is probably playing a lot, because President Macron's reaction to the Venezuela incursion was also very flabby, frankly. And I think he could have said, listen, nobody likes Maduro. He's actually an illegitimate leader. However, the ways to topple him are not acceptable under international law. But I think they were trying to keep the U.S. delegation from coming to Paris and having a productive discussion on Ukraine, which is, quite frankly, a much more existential issue for the Europeans, including the United Kingdom, than Venezuela.
Thank you very much indeed for your time this afternoon. That's Fabrice Potier, who's former head of NATO policy planning. That takes us to 17 minutes past three.
Yes, Donald Trump is making that speech to Republicans at the Kennedy Center. I'm afraid I'm relying on the subtitles on the Sky News feed, and the subtitles are never a really good guide. But he is basically thanking Republican backers and supporters, and indeed referencing a congressman who's suffered what sounds like a pretty bad car accident, and hoping him he has a speedy recovery. But in other words, it's classic rambling Don this afternoon. Any highlights, we will bring them to you before the end of the programme, and there'll be more coverage with John Pienaar after 4 o'clock. Just catching up with some of your messages, a lot of people are keen to point out that the population of Greenland is not 30,000, but nearer to 60,000. So let's make that clear. Thank you for that. And Sophie says, a really interesting book about the Greenland-Denmark relationship is Miss Smiller's Feeling for Snow. Have you read that?
I have read that. I think off the top of my head, it's by Peter Hoag.
Okay. Sophie says, if anybody wants to get themselves better acquainted with the so-called tricky relationship you referenced, that is a great book. Sophie's in Sunbury. Thank you for that. We love hearing your book recommendations. So we'll catch up with what Donald Trump has been saying at the Kennedy Center before 4 o'clock. And we're also going to discuss the ramblers on the North York Moors, who are being told to be exceedingly careful. There could be ordnance lurking. It's Jane and Fee on Times Radio with Wickes, the experts in kitchens and bathrooms.
Global events.
There's a warning that the impact of climate change is getting more severe and we're not prepared.
Breaking news.
Following allegations of potential fraud raised by The Times.
Reactive analysis.
What's going on in the government about discussion of extremism?
From the world's best journalists.
We're trying to look at some of the questions about migration and the implications for the economy, jobs and public services.
On DAB, online, on the app and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio.
Water. It doesn't get nearly enough credit. You drink it, you grow your dinner with it, you wash your bits with it, you surf on it like some kind of levitating wizard. Yes, water is the greatest. Without it, Earth would be just another dry, crusty cosmic fail, like Mars. Think about it. Everything you know and love starts with water. Your dog, your car, your internet, which is basically just a load of sweaty computers get cool in a bath. And then there is just a small miracle of keeping us alive. Without drinking water, you wouldn't survive more than 3 days. Some mates take longer to text you back. So let's raise a glass to clean water. It's hard to imagine life without it. Seriously, how is it that a million people die every year because they lack access to clean water? That's not just unthinkable. That's wrong. Donate to WaterAid today. Just £2 a month can give life-changing clean water.
The Hilton sale is now on, and thankfully it doesn't sound like this. Instead, our sale sounds a bit more like this.
Welcome back.
With a warm welcome, spacious rooms, central locations, and up to 20% off your stay, you can swap chaos for comfort this winter. Book now at Hilton.com. Hilton. For the stay. Offer subject to availability across participating hotels. Terms and conditions apply.
Download the free Times Radio app from the App Store or Google Play today.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wickes Kitchens.
The kitchen sale is now on. Plan your new kitchen with an expert design consultant. Hurry, the early bird discount ends soon. Browse all the kitchen offers at wickes.co.uk. Terms apply.
Are you a rambler? If so, take note. Hikers who love the North York Moors have been told to be very careful about unexploded devices after a wildfire back in August exposed some historic military debris. The advice is very firmly to stick to paths and remain vigilant. We're going to have a word with Carl Robson, who is a bomb disposal expert. Carl, you work for a company called IGNA, is that right? What does that organisation do?
So I work for a business called IGNI UXO.
IGNI, apologies. Yes.
Essentially, we provide risk mitigation for large infrastructure and construction sites.
I see. So you go in before big projects start and make sure it's a completely safe environment.
Yes, indeed. So generally, the process will be identifying a risk in the area. We've got fantastic researchers that carry out a number of processes and draw on a number of archival resources and identify a specific risk within that area. And the next step will generally be to identify what methodology needs to be employed to minimise the risk in the area prior to any construction activities take place.
Right, got you. So how much do you know about this part of the North York Moors?
Well, until this morning, not a great deal, truth be told. What I can say is public discoveries rightly make the headlines remind people to stay vigilant, but they are rare. At IGNI, our daily work is managing unexploded ordnance risks across the UK's construction industry, but it's generally a plan for risk. We have previously managed public risks on sites like this before. For example, we cleared the UXO from the National Trust land after the Studland fires, balancing public safety and access, similar to this,
right.
This incident.
So what we know for sure is that there was a wildfire back in the summer and it revealed all sorts of devices because quite a lot of activity had occurred in this part of Yorkshire during World War II and indeed afterwards. How common is this sort of thing?
Well, it's worth noting this isn't about panic. It's about predictable risk and sensible behaviour. It's, of course, a former training area with legacy ordnance, and changing ground conditions are always going to equal a renewed hazard. Mm. Wildfires don't only burn the vegetation, they can uncover these hazards, which have been buried for generations. So nothing new has appeared. The fires simply stripped off the cover and revealed what's been there for decades. So you can't just, it's impractical to clear the entire area. It's about managing the risk, controlling the access and indeed responding fast to any fines.
So does your company spend most of its time dealing with debris still left over from the Second World War?
That's primarily what we do as a business. Obviously, there is a lot of legacy munitions in the ground, but what we're seeing is more as legacy training areas or indeed military sites are handed over for development or for public access. That's where the risk, of course, is heightened.
So is it simply not possible for the military to make areas entirely safe after a training exercise?
Well, it's about mitigating the risk. So it would start with making the area safe, and indeed weighing up that risk with sensible behaviour and ensuring that the public access is controlled in a fashion against the risk.
Right. I mean, but the public, let's face it, I'm a member of the public. I can be extremely stupid. How would I recognise a dangerous bit of ordnance in a bit of undergrowth?
Well, the guidance isn't to carry out an identification of an item of ordnance as such. The message is quite straightforward. If you do find yourself straying off the path, then don't handle anything. Any metal that looks like it shouldn't be there, don't handle. Create distance, and indeed call it in.
Right. Yeah. Do not touch it. I think we get the message. Thank you very much. That's Carl Robson, a bomb disposal expert.
So we are going to now join President Trump, who is talking at the Trump Kennedy Center. He has started to detail his thoughts about his recent foreign policy.
You know, people are saying it goes down with one of the most incredible. It was so complex. 152 airplanes, many, many. Talk about boots on the ground. We had a lot of boots on the ground. But it was amazing. And think of it. Nobody was killed. And on the other side, a lot of people were killed. Unfortunately, I say that, soldiers. Cubans, mostly Cubans, but many, many killed. And they knew we were coming. And they were protected. And our guys weren't. You know, our guys are jumping out of helicopters. And they're not protected. And they were. But it was so brilliant. The electricity for almost the entire country was boom, turned off. That's when they knew there was a problem. There was no electricity. Caracas, there's no electricity. It's not the only people with lights were the people that had candles. It was just off. So we sort of got them a little by surprise, but it was brilliant tactically. It was an incredible thing. But I watched where Schumer, he's such a bad guy. I mean, I've known the guy for a long time, and he's such a bad guy. You know, at some point they should say, you know, you did a great job. Thank you. Congratulations. Wouldn't it be good? I would say that if they did a good job. Their philosophies are so different. But if they did a good job, I'd be happy for the country. They've been after this guy for years and years and years. And, you know, he's a violent guy. He gets up there and he tries to imitate my dance a little bit. But he's a violent guy. And he's killed millions of people. He's tortured. They have a torture chamber in the middle of Caracas that they're closing up. But he's tortured people. And now what they do, the radical left, they actually have people, and it's hard to get them. They're all paid people. Most of these people are paid. You know they're paid when they have brand new, beautiful printed signs by, like, the highest quality printer. And you have a woman, free Maduro. And the sign is before we even did the attack. You know, free Maduro. Why do you want him freed? I don't know, but he should be free. Oh, she reads a sign. What does that say? It says free. Well, that's what I believe. And, you know, you see the sign. It's like, Lisa, we should all have quality signage like that. The one thing I want their sign maker. The guy is great. He does beautiful signage. You know, the old days was better when they used to write out their own sign, wasn't it? They'd make a sign in the basement. They'd have an old broken board holding up a sign, and it's made with a magic marker, sloppy as hell, and it meant something. But today, when you have that yellow and black, they should use different colors a little bit. But the yellow is a beautiful shade of yellow. No, I want to find out who that is. I want him to work for the Republican campaign. He's much better than our guy, whoever the guy is. But the United States proved once again that we have the most powerful, most lethal, most sophisticated, and most fearsome. It's a fearsome military on planet Earth, and it's not even close. You know, I've been saying it for a long time. Nobody can take us. Nobody. We don't want to have it. We don't have a discussion, but you read all and you see everything else. Nobody could have done that. Nobody has our weapons. Nobody has the quality of our weapons. The problem is we don't produce them fast enough. We're going to start producing them much faster. We're going to be very tough on the companies. We have the best weapons in the world, but it takes too long to get them, including allies. When allies want to buy them, they have to wait 4 years for a plane, 5 years for a helicopter. We're not letting that happen anymore. We're telling our defense contractors, you're going to start building faster. You know, guy makes... I have a big problem with it. I'm the king. I have sold more Boeings than any human being on earth. They gave me an award, Salesman of the Year. I said, what about Salesman of the in the history of Boeing? I've sold more Boeing planes than any man in history by far, probably over 1,000. Over 1,000 planes. I said, that's the good news. But why should they wait 3-4 years to get a plane? They should build them, get them immediately. The F-35s, it takes too long to get them. The Apache helicopter. I mean, I had India coming to me, sir. I've been waiting 5 years.
That's where we're going to leave it. It's Donald Trump. He's talking to an assembled group of Republican politicians. It is one of his absolute peak Trump speeches
where we have had some personal stuff. We have had quite a lot of detail about a woman called Lisa, and we've now gone on to hear his thoughts about how the raid went in Venezuela. Anything else that he chooses to tell us over the next couple of minutes, we will sub it down and we will bring it straight to you.
Right, let's just get a shift on and do something else. We're going to hear very soon from the amazing best-selling author Maggie Farrell. This is ahead of the film adaptation of Hamnet, which is coming out in cinemas this weekend. You are with Times Radio. Good afternoon to you. Here are the latest news headlines. Andy Hayes.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Thank you, Jane. Good afternoon. A sanctioned Venezuelan oil tanker fleeing a US blockade is being monitored by British aircraft. The Marinera is on course to travel north of the UK. The US is reportedly planning to seize it off Ireland. The vessel is part of the so-called Shadow Fleet, carrying oil in breach of sanctions. European leaders say Greenland alone should decide its future after an aide to Donald Trump suggested the US could annex the land unchallenged. Greenland has autonomy but is under the Kingdom of Denmark. The UK, France and Germany say disrupting that could damage the NATO alliance. Conservative leader Kenny Badenoch agrees.
What happens in Greenland should be up to the people of Greenland and the Kingdom of Denmark, not the USA. We are living in an increasingly dangerous world. The NATO alliance is looking fragile. We want to make sure that we keep NATO together.
The first named storm of the year is expected to hit the UK on Thursday, exacerbating the freezing conditions. Forecasters say Goretti is likely to bring more heavy snow. The Prime Minister says tackling the cost of living will be a key focus of his government this year. Sir Keir Starmer again claims the UK is turning the corner. He's held his first cabinet meeting of 2026. And Chelsea have a new manager. Liam Rossini has signed a six-year contract at Stamford Bridge. And for a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing on any podcast platform.
This is Times Radio.
Experience award-winning itineraries from aboard small, luxurious ships with Oceania Cruises. Discover the finest cuisine at sea and exquisitely crafted dining experiences. Enjoy gourmet specialty restaurants and open-seat dining at no additional cost. With over 600 destinations to choose from, explore the world with Oceania Cruises. Visit OceaniaCruises.com or your travel agent.
Turn ordinary into the extraordinary every day with the Lexus LBX. Whilst most SUVs are big and brash, the LBX is quietly bold and confident. Refined luxury crafted into a compact SUV. The Lexus LBX, What Car's Best Small SUV 2024 and 2025.
With over 50 years' experience, at Fidelity, we believe there's a difference between investing and being invested. Investing is having access to guidance, tools and expert insights. Being invested means feeling confident about your future. Investing is choosing from a wealth of investment options. Being invested means focusing on your long-term goals. For ISAs, pensions or advice, be truly invested with Fidelity. Go to fidelity.co.uk. Your capital is at risk. Terms apply.
Download the free Times Radio app and listen to us wherever you are.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens. Choose from over 80 kitchen styles. Whether it's your first home or your forever home, find your dream kitchen at Wix. Prices start from under £3,000. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
Now, Hamnet tells the story of the all-too-short life of Anne Hathaway and William Shakespeare's son. And it's important that Anne comes first in that pairing because Maggie O'Farrell's book, Hamnet, puts her very much at the centre of a family that has, for very obvious reasons, been dominated by the talents of the father and husband. History also doesn't tell us that much about William Shakespeare's role as a dad and husband. And Maggie O'Farrell wanted to explore those themes in her novel too. Hamnet has now been made into a film starring Jesse Buckley and Paul Mescal. It's directed by Chloe Zhao, who won the Oscar for her direction of Nomadland. And Maggie O'Farrell's books have won her the Betty Trask Award, the Costa Novel Award and the Women's Prize for Fiction. More importantly,
they delight her readers. Well, Maggie came in to talk to us a couple of days ago, and I asked her to take us right back to what sparked the original idea for a book about, here comes the second mention, one of Billy the Bard's kids.
Well, it goes right back, actually, Fee, to when I was 16. Not that I'm saying I had a revelation when I was 16 and I thought one day I will write a novel about Shakespeare, but I was studying Hamlet at school and I had a particularly brilliant English teacher who was called Mr. Henderson. And I really loved the play. It really got under my skin. And I think it does appeal to a certain type of teenager, one who maybe wears quite a lot of black clothing. A tailcoat was involved, that's all I'm going to say. Lots of black eyeliner. I did hang around in churchyards taking black and white photographs of me and my friends. So I think, you know, Hamlet does feel familiar to if you're that kind of teenager. But my teacher mentioned in passing one day that Shakespeare had a son who'd been called Hamlet, who died aged 11, and Shakespeare went on 4 years or so later to write the play Hamlet. And even though I was obviously a really long way from being a writer and a mother, it immediately seemed really fascinating to me and really intriguing as to why someone would give the name of their dead son to a play and a prince and a ghost. And I've just always, ever since then, been really intrigued about the link between this lost son and the play.
And Hamlet and Hamnet are interchangeable as a name from Elizabethan times.
In parish records, they're completely interchangeable. Hamnet and Judith, Shakespeare's twin children, were named after their friends, who were called Sadlers, Hamlet and Judith Sadler, who were the bakers in Stratford-upon-Avon. And Hamnet Sadler spells his name loads of different ways. He has a double T, he uses the N for it to be an L. Spelling was a lot less stable in the 16th century.
So is it a story then that you kept on finding you were kind of feeding in your head all the way through since you were 16? I mean, that could only be a couple of years ago, surely, Maggie.
Well, a couple, it's true. I am still a teenager. Yes, that's a good way of putting it, actually. It was a story you keep feeding. It reminds me a bit of a sourdough starter. It's a bit like that in the fridge. Yeah, I kept it in the fridge and I kept thinking about it and I kept buying more books about Shakespeare and reading them. But every now and again, I would have a go at it and then I just think, oh no, I can't, who writes a novel about Shakespeare? That's a mad idea. And also the other thing that kept delaying me was a kind of weird, I'm not a very superstitious person, but I was oddly superstitious about writing this book because I have a son and two daughters, as the Shakespeares did, and I couldn't begin to write it until my own son was past the age of 11. Not that there was a massive risk of him contracting the Black Death, but you never know, you can't be too careful with these things. And so I kept thinking, I can't do it, because I knew that I'd have to put myself inside the skin of a woman who is forced to sit by her son's bedside and watch him die, despite her best efforts.
So I don't think that's superstitious at all.
Do
I
you
think.
Not? Okay,
no,
thank
I think
you.
That's entirely logical, actually. I mean, I wanted to ask you about how it feels to write the death of a child. It's every parent's worst nightmare. Mm. Even if you're not a parent, it's your nightmare. It's a terrible, terrible place to go to in your head that, you know, understandably, most of us pull back from all the time.
Mm. In a way, I mean, yes, it was. I think it's probably the most difficult thing I've ever written. And it took me... I actually kept putting it off. I wrote the first kind of half of the book, and I hope it's not a spoiler to say that Hamlet dies.
No, we're good with that.
He dies about halfway through the novel. So I'd written the first half, and I knew that it was coming up, you know, in my plan for the novel. And I kept just thinking, I'll just go back and rewrite the beginning. I should probably just work a little bit on chapter four and finesse. And I knew that I was kind of refusing it, you know, like a horse refuses a fence. And then I just thought, no, I can't, I have to do it. And it took me about a fortnight, I think, to write the scene of Hamlet's death and then the following scene where his mother lays his body out for burial. And I could only do it in about 10 or 15 minute bursts. And I did it in, I couldn't do it in the house where my children live. I had to do it in a shed in the garden. And it's not a nice shed like Philip Pullman's writing shed. It's a kind of, it was actually at the time, it's actually blown down now in a gale. It was a kind of really horrible manky potting shed. And I would sit in there on a really old garden chair from the 70s. And write a little bit, and then I'd have to go out and have a little walk around the garden, and then I'd go back in, do a bit more. But in a way, I really wanted it to have an impact on the reader, because I felt when I was reading, you know, when I was researching the book and I was reading these huge kind of, you know, 500-page works of amazing scholarship about Shakespeare's biography. But Hamlet is lucky, really, in those books if he gets one or two mentions. And often his death is wrapped up in statistics about how often, how frequent it was that children died in Elizabethan times. You know, the statistics about child mortality. And there's one really respected biographer who actually wrote the line, "It is impossible to know whether or not Shakespeare grieved when Hamlet died."
Wow.
Which, and I made me so cross that book that I threw it across the room, because I thought, how dare you assume, because child mortality was high, that it's anything less than catastrophic? You know, how dare you minimise this child's death? And of course, he, I mean, he was 11. You know, of course he was grieved and he was loved. And you only really have to read the play to understand how much he was grieved and loved. So in a way, I wanted to draw readers' attention to say this child was important and he was grieved. And we owe him so much. You know, without him, we wouldn't have Hamlet and we wouldn't have Twelfth Night.
Is it also a book and now a film, and it has been a play as well? It's like we're doing charades here. is it also a place where you wanted to explore how wives and mothers are often regarded as the shadow of the genius?
Well, I think in a way, Shakespeare's wife, it would have been better for her to be regarded as a shadow. Actually, she's been regarded as a lot worse than that. You know, we've only ever really, and this was something else I discovered from reading around Shakespeare's biography, that we've only ever really been given one narrative about her, and that is that she's this ignorant peasant woman who lured this boy genius into marriage by getting pregnant, apparently on her own. And that he hated her. I mean, people, you know, people have written he hated her. He ran away to London to get away from her. He regretted his marriage. And, you know, I don't know where they've got that from. They must have just plucked it from the ether, because there's literally no evidence that I could find of any of that at all. And actually, there's plenty of evidence to the contrary. So there's two things that I always feel which are documented. I mean, there's not actually much documentary evidence about the woman who people call Anne Hathaway. At all. I mean, there's no record of her birth, because she was born before records began in her village. We know that she got married. We know that she had three children. We know that Hamlet died. We know that she lived quite a long time. She outlived him by 16 years. And we know that she ran a malting business at one point from the back of their house. And that's it. There's nothing else, despite the massive best efforts of all these scholars. But it doesn't matter. From even that very, very scant detail, and there's, of course, the second best bed behest in his will, which I think that's what people have clung on to and said it means he hated her. But
can you just explain that a bit more?
So in Shakespeare's will, which is a document, he was very, very ill when he was dying. I mean, it's possibly from typhoid, which is a particularly nasty death. He leaves her his second best bed. I leave him to my wife, my second best bed. And people have snatched upon this as proof to the theory that he hated her, quite apart from the fact that when he retired, he chose to go back to live with her in Stratford-upon-Avon, and quite apart from the fact that every single penny he earned in London, he sent back to her to Stratford-upon-Avon.
And also, it just might be a bed that's got really, really great memories.
Yes, exactly. You see, the best bed in an Elizabethan household was the one, it stayed in the parlour, and that's where you put your guests. The second best bed was the marriage bed.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
I mean, it's not a movie that's short on lust and love at all. I mean, it's gorgeous in that respect, isn't it? I think you've definitely done Anne, who in the film actually isn't Anne, is she?
No, well, in the book and the film, she's Agnes or Agnes, because one of the big moments for me in writing her character was I read her father's will. So her father, Richard Hathaway, died a year before she married William, and he left her quite a big dowry. And in it, he refers to her as my daughter Agnes or Agnes. And that was amazing to me, because I thought, you know, quite apart from everything else that we've been told to think about her, we've been calling her by the wrong name, because surely if anyone knows her real name, it would be her dad.
Yep. So she's lucky to have you on board to redeem her memory. And Hamlet is too. And I mean, I wonder about that move from it being a book and these characters that in a sense you have control over, don't you, to appearing on the big screen. The first time that you watched the film in the company of other people, did you feel that something had been a bit kind of wrested from you?
No, not at all, actually. And I think if you go into the process, if you are the novelist and you go into the process of a screen adaptation, you can't and shouldn't expect it to be the same as the book. It would be, there would be no point in making a film if it's going to be an exact replica. So I'm really happy that it, with the sense that it sits alongside the book rather than is exact. I mean, you couldn't, you know, it's a different language. The cinema language is different from the language on a page. And I feel that the book is like a, it's not an identical twin to the book, but it's a fraternal twin, like Hamlet and Judith themselves.
Good way of putting it. The emotional response from the audience is phenomenal, and I've been lucky enough to see the film in a preview, and Olivia Colman came on the stage at the beginning and told everybody that we were going to need weepy things, and a couple of people around me in the audience didn't take her note seriously. So about 25 minutes in, there was a lot of rummaging around for some dirty Kleenex at the bottom of bags and stuff. But, I mean, it's a remarkable film in that respect, isn't it? Isn't it? The death of a child to be done so viscerally but sensitively, I think, is quite something.
Mm. Well, I think a huge amount of that is about, a huge amount of that is down to the actors, I think, to Jesse and the extraordinary Jacoby Jupe, who plays Hamlet, who is actually 11 at the time. Well, he was 11 at the time it was filmed. Yeah, he's like a unicorn, Jacoby. I don't know where he comes from or where he's going, but he's extraordinary. He's a very old head on young shoulders. And what was really exceptional was watching him do take after take after take, and he pulled that out of himself somehow every single time. He's extraordinary as Hamlet.
Yeah. Did you cry?
Do you know, it's ridiculous. I wrote the book and I co-wrote the screenplay and I was on set and I've seen the daily rushes and I've seen various versions of the film. And when I did end up seeing it in the cinema, which is at a premiere, and I had my son with me, who's now 22, and I thought, I'm not going to cry this time. Come on, you know, I know this really well. But I did. And also I said to my son at the beginning, I said, just before the lights went down, I said, do you need a tissue? And he said, what did you say? How dare you? And then about halfway through, I just silently handed him a tissue.
There you go.
Yeah.
Yeah. So obey your mother and obey Olivia Colman.
Exactly. Listen to your mum. That's my message.
At all times. Nature plays a huge part in an awful lot of your writing. I think it's one of your enormous strengths. And nature in the film is very important too. And it's quite, I mean, it's big, isn't it? The director has managed to take us right into the Elizabethan countryside.
Well, Chloe Zhao is very good at nature and environment. That was one of the reasons I was really excited when I heard that she was interested in making a film. And I think, you know, when we were approaching the screenplay together, one of the discussions was about how to, you know, which threads of the book we were going to keep from the book to the film, but also about how to, because the book is quite interior in a sense, you know, and how we externalised all that emotion, that interior emotion, and show it on screen. And in some ways it was easy, because we just brought in another character so they could talk instead of just think. But one of the ways, which I think Chloe is brilliant at, and you can see that in her film Nomadland and The Rider, is that she is brilliant at externalising what somebody is feeling by their environment, by the landscape. Mm.
So you get these huge punchy shots of woods and extraordinary kind of decaying trunks and stuff like that. Mm. It's quite glorious.
Yeah, Chloe loves the forest.
Yeah. She's also said something interesting about not really understanding Shakespeare herself. And I wonder whether, I was very grateful she said that as well, because not everybody really, really understands Shakespeare. Small hand going up in the room here. But do you mind that she said that at all?
No, not at all. And I think for me it was a real, I was really, you know, I knew that she was never going to come at this film from a conventional angle, and she wasn't going to make the kind of sort of conventional kind of period drama where everybody looks squeaky clean and there's a lot of mob caps and people go around saying things like, pass me my reticule. You know, I really never wanted to be Hamlet to be that kind of film. And I knew that she was never going to do that. And I think in a sense it was a strength for me that she doesn't necessarily come from a culture where you learn a lot of Shakespeare at school like you do in this country. And I think she's being modest when she said she doesn't understand Shakespeare. I think she does. But in a way, you know, she's told me that Paul Mescal said to her when we were rehearsing Hamlet, which of course happens at the end of the film, the first production of the play, that he'd said to her, it's okay if you don't understand every word, and also that puts you in Agnes's position.
Yeah, which is so beautifully displayed, because you see this grieving mother slightly recognising something and then hearing some words and the recognition gets stronger. You know, it is a remarkable point. And I'm mentioning that, Maggie, not to do a kind of, you know, spoil of the movie, but actually it would be a terrible thing if people were put off seeing the film because they felt that the depiction of a dying child is what defines it, because it's about grief and dealing with it and finding yourself afterwards, isn't it?
Yeah, I never ever wanted the book or the film to end with the death of Hamnet, because that's not the whole story for us anyway, as an audience. And Hamnet dies halfway through the book and the film, and then there is, I hope, a kind of big catharsis that you get towards the end when you see the production of Hamlet. So it is, for me, the book, because the story has always been about where art and stories come from and why we need them.
What happens for you next?
Well, I've written another book, which is coming out in June, and it's called Land, and it tells the whole story of the country of Ireland via one plot of land.
Excellent. That sounds absolutely brilliant. Would you ever consider just writing for the screen, having seen your work up there now?
I would never give up novels. Novels is my first and foremost love. I will always want to write that. But I would be open to doing it again. But I think it would have to be the right story and the right people to work with. I've realised I was so lucky with this, with Hamnet, that the people around me and the people involved and were such, we were all very like-minded and we all wanted the same thing and we all kind of got on well. And I think that's so important in a film. I can't imagine doing that when you didn't have that element of collaboration.
It is a brilliant band of actors, isn't it? I mean, absolute props to all of them.
Incredible. We were so lucky with the cast. They're all amazing.
And Paul Mescal is sporting a little bit of jewellery again, isn't he? Was that on demand?
He is. Well, you see, Shakespeare, the very famous portrait of him, he has an earring. So
yeah, so Paul Mescal's got the little earring.
He stepped up with his earring.
Yeah, I'm thinking that's going to have its own Instagram account, isn't it, by the end of January? I hope so. Although there are other scenes of Paul Mescal in the film that I think might stir in people's minds too. You can't see the movie, you'll see exactly what I'm referring to. Hamlet is out in cinemas this weekend, and Land, Maggie O'Farrell's next novel set in Ireland, is out later this year. You're off to see Hamlet, aren't you, at the weekend?
I'm drawn to it not by Paul Mescal, but by, as you know, my lifelong love of William Shakespeare and his works.
Okay.
And I'm sure I speak for many, many female of the species types when I say that.
I'm sure you do.
Yeah.
Right.
I know, the book is amazing, so I'm confident the film will be something very special as well.
It is special indeed.
Yeah. Right, tomorrow we've got another big guest and we'll talk about him in a moment or two, but that's after these.
Times Radio, Market Watch. In association with FNC Investment Trust. Listen to Times Radio to hear all the latest financial news from all the global stock markets. Get insight, analysis, and up-to-the-minute information to help you get the most from your investment portfolio. Times Radio, Market Watch. Throughout the day, every Monday to Friday, on Times Radio, in association with FNC. It's smart to start with FNC. Find out more at fnc.com. Capital at risk.
The Story. The award-winning daily news podcast from The Times. Listen in the Times Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
I thought that I'd seen beauty. Then I sailed where icebergs gleam. I thought I'd witnessed nature, but this surpassed my dream. I thought that I'd known wonder, then sailed beneath these skies. I thought I'd seen the world until I opened my eyes. Change the way you see the world with HX Expeditions. Search Travel HX to discover more.
What's the feeling you get at David Lloyd Clubs? Well, let's just say that when you've experienced the tranquility of our spas, felt the feel-good intensity of a workout class, enjoyed your little one's happy faces, making friends in the kids' club, and relaxed together as a family in our club rooms, this radio ad won't be the only thing on air. Elevate your every day with David Lloyd Clubs. Try a 3-month membership today. Terms and conditions apply.
Feel that? That little buzz of excitement? That's the weekly flutter.
with chances to win up to £10,000, enter British Heart Foundation's lottery for a thrill with goodwill behind it. Because when you play, it helps fund life-saving research. So go on, keep playing, keep winning, keep us beating. Search BHF Lottery. Gamble responsibly, over 18s only. T's and C's apply. Please see our website for more details. British Heart Foundation is a registered charity.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, and on your smart speaker, Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
And that is us. We are in association with Wix. You can book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk. We've had so many wonderful messages this afternoon. Many of you do not want to hear anything else from President Donald Trump, particularly in your afternoons. They're just like a little clear run for a couple of hours, knowing that the orange blimp isn't going to appear. We aren't really contractually obliged, and because we are a news station, yes, to bring you details of what President Trump is talking about.
The man is newsworthy.
There's no denying it. He is newsworthy, but we also thoroughly appreciate your sentiments on the matter, and we love receiving your messages, particularly Glyn, who would rather have been in the Gibbons cage at London Zoo this afternoon. Edward simply enjoyed Fabrice Potier's pronunciation of this word.
Flabby.
It's a joyful
flabby.
Phrase.
Yeah, it's lovely. Why flabby. Is everything said in a French accent a little
flabby?
Yeah, nicer. It's just nicer.
It's great.
No one wants to be called flabby, but I wouldn't mind being called flabby.
Flabby.
Exactly.
Superb.
All right, that's enough.
It's a good spot, Edward. We enjoyed it too.
No, we definitely did. There's a lovely message from Mark about Hamlet. Do you want to read that? Because that's very, I don't know, it's just incredibly clever sound. He's very erudite.
Here we go. There was a new award-winning book published in 2024, Psychology According to Shakespeare, What You Can Learn About Human Nature from Shakespeare's Great Plays, by Professor Philip Zimbardo and Dr. Robert Johnson. If Hamlet was named after Shakespeare's friend Hamlet Sadler, perhaps Hamlet was simply the bard's way of assuring the legacy of his son. Well, that's the story that is told in the film, Mark. Mm. Or perhaps more sinisterly, one might ask which parent had primary influence in choosing the name of the son. Did Anne, was Mr. Sadler, in fact, the father of Hamlet Jr., conceived with his neighbour Anne while Will was away in London? What does that kind of thing happen, Mark? Astonishing.
I don't think so. Will was busy writing his plays in London and Anne had a bit of How's Your Father with a Neighbour. No, I mean, we can't cast aspersions on a woman who, as is evident in both the book and the film, suffered so terribly in life. Anyway, right, that's the view of, well, that's a theory, which we've put out there now and we can't turn back.
We have. I think that's Hamlet Hollyoaks.
Hollyoaks.
We might leave that for another time.
I think we should do. Right, our guest tomorrow is Jake Humphrey, and we like to kick off every year with a bit of Jake. And he has got a new book out, Micro Habits, Tiny Changes That Supercharge High Performance. And if you're a regular listener to this programme, you'll know all about high performance. and Jake will be able to galvanise not just Fee and I, but hopefully you as well, at around about 3:30 tomorrow afternoon.
You've read all of his books on achieving marginal
and look
gain.
At me.
So this one, has it really ticked your boxes?
Well, one of his tips, it's something he does himself, he's just getting up 15 minutes earlier than usual so he can just do more.
Sounds very sensible. Yep. Our producer today was Felix Forbes. Our technical operator was Ryan Boyden. Up next, John Peanut with Drive. Enjoy your evening when you get to it.
Flabby.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Thank you, Fee. Thank you, Jane. At 4 o'clock, I'm John Pienaar, and this is Times Radio Drive. Here are the headlines. A sanctioned Venezuelan oil tanker fleeing a US blockade is being monitored by British aircraft as it approaches UK waters. And European leaders say Greenland should decide its future, as an aide to Donald Trump suggests the US could annex the land unchallenged. And coming up, I'll be taking stock of the situation with foreign affairs expert Tim Marshall and talking to Christopher Hernandez-Roy, the director of the Americas Programme at the Centre for Strategic Studies in Washington. And we'll be crossing to Denmark. I'll talk to a man who used to be responsible for the country's relations with Greenland. Later, we'll be checking on the Coalition of the Willing talks in Paris. I've been talking to a senator from France and a former head of the British Army who will be joining me, and an MP from Ukraine.
This is Times Radio.
And here's the news with Andy Hayes.
Thank you, John. Good afternoon.
A sanctioned Venezuelan oil tanker fleeing a US blockade is being monitored by British aircraft. The Marinera is on course to travel north of the UK. The US is reportedly planning to seize it off Ireland. Ollie Cole has more details from the Times newsroom.
The vessel is part of the so-called Shadow Fleet carrying oil in breach of sanctions. It's changed its official flag to that of Russia, while crew have painted a Russian flag on its side. And it's also changed its name and is on a course that may cut into Irish or Danish waters. It could be attempting to reach the Russian Arctic port of Murmansk and is being monitored by two US P-8 surveillance aircraft flying from RAF Mildenhall in Suffolk. This morning, a British Eurofighter Typhoon departing from RAF Lossiemouth could be seen flying in its direction. Irish and French aircraft are also involved.
Swiss authorities have revealed that the bar where 40 people died in a New Year fire had not been inspected since 2019. The mayor of Crans, Montana, has also announced that sparklers, which are blamed for starting the blaze, are now banned inside venues. An expert police review said Israeli football fans should have been allowed to attend a football match against Aston Villa in Birmingham. That was more than 2 weeks before the fixture against Maccabi Tel Aviv and after a ban had been previously recommended. A decision to ban supporters was made after police received intelligence that locals in the predominantly Muslim area were hostile to the Maccabi fans. There were fears that some people could have armed themselves. The decision has been branded anti-Semitic. Sir Keir Starmer has again insisted the country is turning a corner. He's been hosting the first cabinet meeting of the year.
But the next general election, we will be judged on whether we've delivered on the things that really matter. Do people feel better off? Are public services improving, for which they will look to the NHS? And do people feel more safe and secure in their own community? They are the issues we'll be judged on for the next general election, and that is our focus.
If more pensioners are to be stopped from driving, then the government must ensure good public transport across the UK. That's the reaction of Age UK to government plans for regular eye tests for drivers over 70 as part of new road safety measures. Christopher Brooks is the charity's head of policy.
We've experienced declining bus services in recent years, which makes it harder for people to get out and about. Perhaps the government should also be looking at other ways they can help people get around their local communities and even further afield, like looking at how public transport is funded and whether there are other things that could be done to help people.
And a major incident has been declared in Aberdeenshire, where the council is warning that rural communities could be cut off because of heavy snow. An MP has called for the army to help deliver essentials to people who are isolated. Storm Goretti is due to bring more snow. And for a roundup of the news on demand, subscribe to the Times News Briefing on any podcast platform.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. John Pienaar at Drive on Times Radio.
Hello, I'm John Pienaar with Drive on Times Radio. Thanks for joining me. Now, Donald Trump quite often rambles. He's rather rambling now in the course of a long speech in Washington, D.C. He also lies when it suits him, and it suits him quite often. But when he tells us, as only he can and only he would, that his only interest is what's in America's interest, his own interests, in other words, because to him they're one and the same, we can believe him. And today, now, there's no avoiding the obvious truth. Much as Keir Starmer and the leaders of France and Germany and across Western Europe and the president of Ukraine may try to avoid this truth, those European leaders are sitting together at the Elysee Palace in Paris now, this time along President Trump's envoys and senior advisers, who also happen to be his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, and his business former partner, Steve Witkoff. And they're discussing proposals for a multinational force to oversee a ceasefire in Ukraine when there is a ceasefire to oversee. Now, we're going to be live with the big news conference from Starmer, President Macron of France, and Chancellor Merz of Germany, and Volodymyr Zelensky later in the programme. Maybe we'll hear more of how the United States may give support to that peacekeeping effort. Unless, of course, we don't. But what we won't hear is the plain truth. The truth that Western leaders are so anxious to avoid saying. That the Atlantic Alliance that we've known for the past 80 years is as good as dead. Dead, along with the rules-based global order replaced by the doctrine that might is right. That America's cause is America's interest, as we see in Venezuela now. And all the world can do about that is wonder where American might may descend next. Greenland? Now, as for Ukraine, top of the agenda in Paris this afternoon, Ukraine's defence against the other strongman in the Kremlin, Vladimir Putin, is overwhelmingly, it seems, Ukraine's problem, with whatever help Ukraine supporters at the table in Paris can give. Now, in a moment, you'll get the best analysis you'll hear anywhere from Tim Marshall, the author, the veteran journalist and the foreign affairs analyst. And later, senior diplomats and politicians from the USA, Denmark, France and Ukraine are joining me on the programme. Well, what is changing in the world? The answer is pretty much everything. Stay with us. And do tell me your hopes and fears at this moment. Send me a text, 87222, start with the word Times, or a tweet to @TimesRadio. I want to start the programme with some breaking news, though. It's leading the Times Online now. A shadow tanker, which is fleeing a US blockade on oil leaving Venezuela, is being monitored by British aircraft as speculation grows that US forces may try to board it. And with the latest, the Times reporter Emma Yeomans. Hello to you, Emma.
Hi there.
Hi, welcome, Emma. Do please get us up to date with this story.
Yes, so this is a tanker called the Marinera, which is part of the shadow fleet. That means it carries oil that is under sanctions or it's under price blockade. And in this case, it's carrying Venezuelan oil away from the US blockade on Venezuela. So this tanker was pursued by the US Coast Guard late last year, who failed to catch up with it. And at that point, the tanker rebranded itself, reflagged as a Russian vessel, prompting Russia to ask the US to stop chasing it. It's now crossed most of the way across the Atlantic and is set to pass somewhere north of the UK, probably quite close to Iceland and the Faroe Islands, on, we think, its way to a Russian Arctic port in Murmansk.
Right, so, yeah, do carry
but
on.
But we believe today the RAF has flown out to monitor it. We could see a flight leaving from RAF Lossiemouth in the north of Scotland and heading towards this tanker. And this follows a series of flights by US and NATO allies to check on the progress of this tanker.
And so, Emma, tell me, what would be the appropriate handling of this tanker? Britain involved in monitoring its progress. What might be the outcome of all of this, where the British surveillance is concerned or any other?
Well, the fear at this stage is that President Trump may order the US forces to seize the tanker or attempt to intercept it. We've seen it do that with other vessels in the vicinity of Venezuela already. Currently, there isn't really a normal response to the shadow fleet. In fact, we see a lot of Russian shadow fleet vessels pass through the English Channel every day, every week, pretty much unimpeded, because it's generally accepted.